Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature George Packer. He was a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker until he joined The Atlantic in early 2019. In addition to his magazine journalism, Packer is also the author of some of the most celebrated nonfiction of the last decade, including the National Book Award-winning The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, and The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Packer joined us in Portland in October 2019 to talk about his new book, Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century. I can say with absolute confidence that it is like no other biography you have ever read. At once intimate and epic, the book follows Holbrooke's career from Vietnam to Afghanistan, through three marriages, from the Foreign Service to the White House, from Kennedy to Obama, telling the story of this, quote, almost great man in a conversational, at times even gossipy style that often reads more like a novel than a biography. In both the biography and in the talk, Packer makes a convincing case why we should all care about a relatively obscure diplomat. He argues that Holbrooke embodied America's approach to foreign policy in the 20th century, and even America's idea of itself. Packer traces the arc of our recent history with remarkable insight, and in doing so, sheds important light on where we find ourselves today. Here's Packer.
Thank you, Portland. This is kind of thrilling, and I even had to take a picture of the marquee outside to prove to my family that this was actually happening. And now I'll just pretend that there's only 15 people here. I'm going to read just a few pages from the prologue of the book so that then I can talk about it with some words in your head already. Holbrooke? Yes, I knew him. I can't get his voice out of my head. I still hear it, saying, you haven't read that book, you really need to read it. Saying, I feel, and I hope this doesn't sound too self-satisfied, that in a very difficult situation, where nobody has the answer, I at least know what the overall questions and moving parts are. Or saying, gotta go, Hillary's on the line. That voice, calm, nasal, a trace of older New York, a sing-song cadence when he was being playful, but always doing something to you, cajoling, flattering, bullying, seducing, needling, analyzing, one-upping you, applying continuous pressure like a strong underwater current, so that by the end of a conversation, even 2 minutes on the phone, you found yourself far out from where you'd started, unsure how you got there, and mysteriously exhausted. He was 6'1", but seemed bigger. He had long, skinny limbs and a barrel chest and broad, square shoulder bones on top of which sat his strangely small head. And encased within it, the sleepless brain. His feet were so far from his trunk that as his body wore down and the blood stopped circulating properly, they swelled up and became marbled red and white like steak. He had special shoes made and carried extra socks in his leather attaché case, sweating through half a dozen pairs a day, stripping them off on long flights and draping them over his seat pocket in first class, or else cramming used socks next to the classified documents in his briefcase. He wrote his book about ending the war in Bosnia, the place in history that he always craved, though it was never enough, with his feet planted in a Brookstone Shiatsu foot massager. One morning, he showed up late for a meeting in the Secretary of State's suite at the Waldorf Astoria in his stocking feet, shirt untucked and fly half zipped, padding around the room and picking grapes off a fruit basket while Madeleine Albright's furious stare tracked his every move. During a video conference call from the UN mission in New York, his feet were propped up on a chair, while down in the White House Situation Room, their giant distortion completely filled the wall screen and so disrupted the meeting that President Clinton's national security advisor finally ordered a military aide to turn off the video feed. Holbrooke put his feet up anywhere, in the White House, on other people's desks and coffee tables, for relief and for advantage. Near the end, it seemed as if all his troubles were collecting in his feet. Atrial fibrillation, marital tension, thwarted ambition, conspiring colleagues, hundreds of thousands of air miles, corrupt foreign leaders, a war that would not yield to the relentless force of his will. But at the other extreme from his feet, the ice blue eyes were on perpetual alert. Their light told you that his intelligence was always awake and working. They captured nearly everything and gave almost nothing away. Like one-way mirrors, they looked outward, not inward. I never knew anyone quicker to size up a room, an adversary, a newspaper article, a set of variables in a complex situation, even his own imminent death. The ceaseless appraising told of a manic spirit churning somewhere within the low voice and languid limbs. Once in the 1980s, he was walking down Madison Avenue when an acquaintance passed him and called out, "Hi, Dick." Holbrooke watched the man go by, then turned to his companion. "I wonder what he meant by that." Yes, his curly hair never obeyed the comb, and his suit always looked rumpled, and he couldn't stay off the phone or TV, and he kept losing things, and he ate as much food as fast as he could, once slicing open the tip of his nose on a clamshell and bleeding through a pair of cloth napkins. Yes, he was in almost every way a disorderly presence, but his eyes never lost focus. So much thought, so little inwardness. He could not be alone. He might have had to think about himself. Maybe that was something he couldn't afford to do. Leslie Gelb, Holbrooke's friend of 45 years and recipient of multiple daily phone calls, would butt into a monologue and ask, "What's Obama like?" Holbrooke would give a brilliant analysis of the president. "How do you think you affect Obama?" Holbrooke had nothing to say. Where did it come from, that blind spot behind his eyes that masked his inner life? It was a great advantage over the rest of us because the propulsion from idea to action was never broken by self-scrutiny. It was also a great vulnerability, and in the end, it was fatal. I can hear the voice saying, "It's your problem now, not mine." He loved speed. Franz Klammer's fearless downhill run for the gold in 1976 was a feat Holbrooke never finished admiring until you almost believed that he had been the one throwing himself into those dangerous turns at Innsbruck. He pedaled his bike straight into a swarming Saigon intersection while talking about the war to a terrified blonde journalist just arrived from Manhattan. He zipped through Paris traffic while lecturing his State Department boss on the status of the Vietnam peace talks. His Humvee careered down the dirt switchbacks of the Mount Igman Road above besieged Sarajevo, chased by the armored personnel carrier with his doomed colleagues. He loved mischief. It made him endless fun to be with and got him into unnecessary trouble. In 1967, he was standing outside Robert McNamara's office on the second floor of the Pentagon, a 26-year-old junior official hoping to catch the Secretary of Defense on his way in or out for no reason other than self-advancement. A famous colonel was waiting too, a decorated paratrooper back from Vietnam, where Holbrooke had known him. Everything about the colonel was pressed and creased, his uniform shirt, his face, his pants carefully tucked into his boots and delicately bloused around the calves. He must have spent the whole morning on them. "That looks really beautiful," Holbrook said, and he reached down and yanked a pants leg all the way out of its boot. The colonel started yelling. Holbrook laughed. Back in the Kennedy and Johnson years, when he was elbowing his way into public life, the phrase "action intellectuals" was hot, until Vietnam caught up with it and intellectuals got burned. But that was Holbrook. Ideas mattered to him, but never for their own sake, only if they produced solutions to problems. The only problems worth his time were the biggest, hardest ones. Three fiendish wars. That's what his career came down to. He was almost singular in his eagerness to keep risking it. Having solved Bosnia, he wanted Cyprus, Kosovo, Congo, the Horn of Africa, Tibet, Iran, India, Pakistan, and finally Afghanistan. Only the Middle East couldn't tempt him. As the Washington bureaucracy got more cautious, his appetite for conquests grew. Right after his death, Hillary Clinton said, "I picture him like Gulliver, tied down by Lilliputians." He loved history so much that he wanted to make it. The phrase "great man" now sounds anachronistic, but as an inspiration for human striving, maybe we shouldn't throw out the whole idea. He came of age when there was still a place for it, and that place could only be filled by an American. This was just after the war, when the ruined world lay prone and open to the visionary action of figures like Acheson, Kennan, Marshall, and Harriman. They didn't just grab for land and gold like the great men of earlier empires. They built the structures of international order that would endure for three generations, longer than anything ever lasts, and that are only now turning to rubble. These were unsentimental, supremely self-assured, white Protestant men, privileged, you could say, born around the turn of the century, who all knew one another and knew how to get things done. They didn't take a piss without a strategy. Holbrook revered them all and adopted a few as replacement fathers. He wanted to join them at the top, and he clawed his way up the slope of an establishment that was crumbling under his crampons. He reached the highest base camp possible, but every assault on the summit failed. He loved books about mountaineers, and in his teens, he climbed the Swiss Alps. He was a romantic. He never realized that he had come too late. You will have heard that he was a monstrous egotist. It's true. It's even worse than you've heard. I'll explain as we go on. He offended countless people, and they didn't forget. And since so many of them swallowed their hurt, after he was gone, it was usually the first thing out of their mouth if his name came up, as it invariably did. How he once told a colleague, "I lost more money in the market today than you make in a year." How he bumped an elderly survivor couple from the official American bus to Auschwitz on the 50th anniversary of its liberation, added himself to the delegation alongside Elie Wiesel, and left the weeping couple to beg Polish guards to let them into the camp so they wouldn't miss the ceremony. How he lobbied for the Nobel Peace Prize. That kind of thing, all the time, as if he needed to discharge a surplus of self every few hours to maintain his equilibrium. And the price he paid was very high. He destroyed his first marriage and his closest friendship. His defects of character cost him his dream job as Secretary of State, the position for which his strengths of character eminently qualified him. You can't untangle these things. I used to think that if Holbrook could just be fixed, a dose of self-restraint, a flash of inward light, he could have done anything. But that's an illusion. We are wholly ourselves. If you cut out the destructive element, you would kill the thing that made him almost great. As a member of the class of lesser beings who aspire to a good life but not a great one, who find the very notion both daunting and distasteful, I can barely fathom the agony of that almost. Think about it, the nonstop schedule, the calculation of every dinner table, the brain that burned all day and night, and the knowledge buried so deep he might have only sensed it as a physical ache that he had come up short of his own impossible exaltation. I admired him for that readiness to suffer. His life was full of pleasures, but I never envied it. I'm trying to think what to tell you now that you have me talking. There's too much to say, and it all comes crowding in at once. His ambition, his loyalty, his cruelty, his fragility, his betrayals, his wounds, his wives, his girlfriends, his sons, his lunches. By dying, he stood up 100 people, including me. He could not be alone. If you're still interested, I can tell you what I know from the beginning. I wasn't one of his close friends, but over the years I made a study of him. You ask why? Not because he was extraordinary, though he was, and might have rivaled the record of his heroes if he and America had been in their prime together. Not because he was fascinating, though he was, and right this minute, somewhere in the world, 14 people are talking about him. I won't relate this story for his sake. No, we want to see and feel what happened to America during Holbrooke's life. And we can see and feel more clearly by following someone who was almost great, because his quest leads us deeper down the alleyways of power than the usual famous subjects, whom he knew, all of them. And his boisterous struggling lays open more human truths than the composed annals of the great. This was what Les Gelb must have meant when he said, just after his friend's death, "Far better to write a novel about Richard Holbrooke than a biography, let alone an obituary." What's called the American century was really just a little more than half a century, and that was the span of Holbrooke's life. It began with the Second World War and the creative bursts that followed, the United Nations, the Atlantic Alliance, containment, the free world, and it went through dizzying highs and lows until it expired the day before yesterday. The thing that brings on doom to great powers and great men, is it simple hubris or decadence and squander, a kind of inattention, loss of faith, or just the passage of years? At some point, that thing set in, and so we're talking about an age gone by. It wasn't a golden age. There was plenty of folly and wrong, but I already miss it. The best about us was inseparable from the worst. Our feeling that we could do anything gave us the Marshall Plan and Vietnam, the peace at Dayton, and the endless Afghan War. Our confidence and energy, our reach and grasp, our excess and blindness, they were not so different from Holbrooke's. He was our man. That's the reason to tell you this story. That's why I can't get his voice out of my head. Thanks. So, how did this book come to be written? So, a few weeks after Holbrooke died in December 2010, his widow gave me his personal papers with no strings attached. She didn't know what was in them. She just gave them to me. There were these giant black filing cabinets sitting in an office in Lower Manhattan. And so, within a week of our agreement, they were on a moving van crossing the Brooklyn Bridge to my small home office in Brooklyn, where you can see them preventing me from getting to my books and even keeping the doors from opening all the way. That was Holbrooke. He took over my office. He took over my life. What was in those papers? Lots of letters, a an incredible trove of letters that he had written to his first wife when he was in Vietnam in the early 60s, recorded diaries, I'll play you a little bit of one at the end, that he kept during key moments while he was negotiating the Bosnian War, while he was working on Afghanistan, scraps of paper, hotel stationery on which he'd written thoughts to himself. Not systematic, but incredibly revealing. And I spent a year or two going through them while I was imagining Holbrook himself in my room. I felt his presence, like very close, almost looking over my shoulder saying, "What are you doing reading my diaries? And what the hell is taking you so long?" Because something was taking me so long. And what was blocking me was I did not know how to write the book. I actually have to admit that I find most biographies kind of boring. That's a confession maybe of my own limitations. But there's a sense in which the biographer feels that he or she has to include everything. So they spend 20 years of their life gathering every last detail about the subject's seventh grade school record and every move that her family made and every job that he got. And by the end, you don't even know why you've read all this. That was my nightmare biography, the one that I knew I couldn't write and didn't want to write because my subject was not an obvious subject. I mean, I don't know how many of you have heard of Richard Holbrook, but I find that a mere 9 years after his death, this man who really dominated so much of American foreign policy while he was alive is already being forgotten. And among younger Americans, he really isn't known. There was not a great audience waiting for the biography of Richard Holbrook. It just wasn't a book that needed to be written. I had his papers, and I'd kind of been given them before I even knew why I was writing the book, and so I had to figure it out myself. I had to figure out how to write a book that would kind of create a readership for a biography of Richard Holbrook. One day I was driving on an interstate in Connecticut, and I heard a voice, which rarely happens to me because I'm probably far too practical and rational, but I did hear a voice, and the voice said, "Holbrook, yes, I knew him." I nearly drove off the highway. What was that? Who was that? It didn't sound like a biography, but it sounded to me like something interesting, even exciting. I began to wonder, what if I tried to write the whole book in the voice of that person who just said, "Holbrook, yes, I knew him," whoever that person was. At first it seemed impossible because that's not how biographies sound. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, no, this is what I need. I need to write a book that doesn't sound like a biography. I need to write a book that sounds like a novel. And a novel that's got a narrator. This is a book of facts. There's 30 pages of notes at the end. It's been fact-checked to within an inch of its life, as correct as I could make it, except one thing is invented, and that's the voice of the narrator. It's not my voice. It's the voice of someone older than me, wiser, more experienced, almost like someone who just happened to know Holbrook all along, was there for the entire story. You don't quite know how. Maybe a kind of amalgamation of some of the voices of his friends, whom I had spent hours and hours interviewing. It had an authority and a kind of knowingness that I didn't feel I had. Being younger and less experienced, and I was 3 years old when Holbrook was in Vietnam. I didn't know anything about it firsthand, but if I had a narrator, I thought, who could convey a sense of intimate knowledge of the subject, then I might be able to find a way to write the story that didn't sink under the dead weight of facts, which so many biographies do. I was thinking in a way of some of Conrad's novels, which are narrated by his sailor hero, Marlowe. I thought of this as like a yarn, like a long night's yarn in which you sit down with the narrator and he tells you the story of Holbrook. And I'm gonna show you the man I'm talking about. This is in the last years of his life. He still seems in command, but as you'll find out as I go on, he was at this point not in command. I felt that as a writer, I had to come by the knowledge honestly. I had to interview a couple of hundred people. I had to read all those papers in those filing cabinets, plus thousands of pages more. But my narrator would not carry the weight of all that research. You would never come across an interview in the book. You would never hear about a source, a transcript. You could find them in the notes, but the narration itself would feel like a yarn. And somehow the narrator had been an eyewitness to the whole saga. I felt that Holbrooke demanded this kind of book because the cliche larger than life did not even begin to describe him. And the kind of aloof, distant, neutral voice of a biographer would just be crushed next to the overwhelming weight of his personality and would not be able to do it justice. His achievements, his failings, both of which were on a large scale, and his abiding importance could only be brought to life through the eyes of a narrator who seemed to have seen the span of history that I have not, and who has a keenly personal knowledge of America's dreams and defeats and battles with itself. Only that narrator could fully evoke Holbrooke as a poignant agent of those dreams and embody the spirit of a whole era. So what do I mean by all this? Well, first, there was his career. He served under every Democratic president from Kennedy to Obama. Hillary Clinton told me that he was the Zelig of American foreign policy. He showed up everywhere, always in the middle of the action. Here he is, apparently enjoying himself in the Mekong Delta in South Vietnam. In 1963, he was a 22-year-old Foreign Service officer, and this was his first post, and he was having the time of his life. He wanted to see the war, he wanted to be in the middle of the action, and he was sent to one of the most dangerous provinces at that time in Vietnam, in the Mekong Delta, where the war was at its hottest. And he was given an unusual job for a young diplomat. He became a kind of aid worker, living in a small town, working with local Vietnamese, handing out bulgur weed and building materials, and also training the local self-defense militia. In other words, he was seeing the war right up close at ground level. And he saw two things right away. One was we were losing. He saw that within weeks of arriving, and he knew it because he could see that we were fighting the war against an insurgency as if it was a conventional war, as if it was World War II. And coming in with the South Vietnamese army with heavy artillery and air power and killing a lot of civilians and turning the survivors into enemies, or at least into deeply unhappy peasants. He saw all that right away at age 22. The other thing he saw was that we were lying to ourselves. He was reading reports that were being written by soldiers down at the ground where he was in the Delta, going to Saigon, and the reports continuing on to Washington and ending up on President Kennedy's desk. And those reports were showing victory after victory and a successful program of building what were called strategic hamlets. Well, Holbrooke was responsible for the strategic hamlets in his area, and he knew that they were failing, that they were being overrun by the Viet Cong, that essentially the Viet Cong owned the countryside. He saw all of that, and it shocked him, because he went into the world believing that America could do no wrong, that we were the good guys. That came from his upbringing, which I'll tell you about in a minute. He thought that we were on the side of right and that the war in Vietnam was a war for freedom and democracy. And he compared it to something going on at that same moment in Birmingham, Alabama, the civil rights movement, the freedom struggle in the South. He thought they were both parts of the same global effort for human liberation. So he had an idealist view of Vietnam, and right away that view came under this pressure of what he was seeing. And he was honest enough and smart enough to take in the unpleasant facts, and even to start talking about them to his superiors. Tennis is a major theme of my book. Holbrooke used his tennis skills to schmooze and to operate and network. Here he is, probably having just beaten Maxwell Taylor, who's to the left on a tennis court in Saigon. He was very competitive, but he also used tennis in order to get to know powerful people. He played with Maxwell Taylor and William Westmoreland, and eventually back in Washington with Bobby Kennedy, and brought himself to the attention of these important men and quickly began to work his way up. Because for him, his own career was always just important as whatever project or war or goal the American foreign policy was pursuing. But he told these superiors of his what he was seeing, and they didn't always want to hear it. And I think one of his virtues was his willingness to tell his bosses the hard truth, even when it was unwelcome. And it became kind of his calling card. He was known as consumingly ambitious, but also as someone who had clear eyes and was willing to tell the truth. He went back to Washington in 1966 after 3 years in Vietnam and worked in the Johnson White House, again on civilian counterinsurgency, this time from Washington. Here he is, age 25, telling Lyndon Johnson that he really didn't know very much about Vietnam. That he couldn't do whatever he wanted because Vietnam had its own reality. Johnson didn't want to hear it. A couple of years later, having schmoozed his way through Georgetown dinner parties, he was chosen to work, to go off to Paris on the very first peace talks with the North Vietnamese under Averill Harriman, who was one of his mentors. He was the youngest member of the American delegation. The talks went nowhere. Richard Nixon was elected, and Holbrooke left the State Department to do other things. He became the editor of Foreign Policy magazine. He left his wife and sons. He became a swinger in Washington in the 70s. He sort of used both his social life and his ambitions together in order to advance himself. He once told a girlfriend that he wanted to be the next Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger once called Holbrooke the most viperous man I know around this town, which is really something coming from Henry Kissinger. He went back into government when Jimmy Carter was elected. He kind of picked Carter out very early on and saw him as a winner, and it was the right call, and Carter named him his Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, and again, Holbrooke was the youngest one ever to hold that job. He participated in the normalization of relations between the U.S. and China. Here he is on the Great Wall. In the middle of the picture, you might recognize Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's looking pretty pleased with himself. And well, he should, because he had essentially just had Richard Holbrooke for breakfast. You can tell on the side from his expression that Holbrooke is not looking happy. He and Brzezinski hated each other and got into a tremendous bureaucratic battle because Holbrooke had tried to convince Carter not to hire Brzezinski as his national security advisor, and when the word got back to Brzezinski, well, that was the end of Richard Holbrooke, except that Holbrooke was a pretty tough fighter himself. And one thing I realized in researching these stories is how brutal government work could be. How intense the fighting when you're close to the top of the treetops, when power is all around you and there's not much space for the giant egos of the people who get to that level. It often ends up that they fight each other far more viciously than they seem to pursue the fight against America's enemies. Holbrooke survived the death struggle with Brzezinski. And by the way, they agreed about almost everything, which often seems to make the infighting even more vicious than if they were actual opponents. I think there's a lot of analogies to what's happening today. In the 90s, he became Clinton's Assistant Secretary for Europe. In other words, he was staying at about the same bureaucratic level, Assistant Secretary of State, not exactly the most glorious and celebrated jobs, but he always used the jobs he got well beyond the supposed power he was supposed to have. And he used this job to negotiate with Slobodan Milosevic, who he's drinking there with at Dayton, to end the worst fighting, the worst killing in Europe since the Second World War. And that became Holbrooke's real claim to fame. He was the one person in the Clinton administration who had the shamelessness, the persistence, the bullying, the sheer drive to confront and really master the butcher of the Balkans, Slobodan Milosevic, where other diplomats had failed. Holbrooke showed that diplomacy, which we think of as this polite encounter across the tea table between men in suits, is actually a raw arena of the human psyche in contest with other human psyches, each trying to read the other, trying to outmaneuver the other, outlast the other, while figuring out what the other would settle for. It's a really, a far more human and I'd say just a naked kind of combat than I had ever imagined. And with Holbrooke, who took it to that level, it's high drama. And at Dayton, he risked everything and he won. And even though Bosnia today is a dysfunctional country, at least the killing stopped. And that was Holbrooke's great achievement. But then came his last go-round under Barack Obama. And as you can see from the body language in this picture, Obama didn't like him. In fact, Obama really didn't like him. Holbrooke was everything that Obama felt a kind of, I think, almost a visceral revulsion toward. He was long-winded. He was self-dramatizing. He was full of drama. Obama was no drama. He lectured Obama. He flattered Obama. In fact, the first time they met was in 2008, just after the triumphant election that made Obama president. Holbrooke had supported Clinton because he was a Clinton person, and he and Hillary were very close. He had to make an abrupt shift in order to try to get a job under Barack Obama, who didn't know him, but who was surrounded by people who had been telling Obama bad things about Holbrooke because they were among the enemies Holbrooke had been accumulating throughout his career. And now they were next to Barack Obama, people like Susan Rice and Anthony Lake. Obama nonetheless invited Holbrooke to Chicago to his transition headquarters to interview him. And in the first minute, Holbrooke made three mistakes. The first was to hand his own book on Bosnia to Obama, signed copy, which is kind of par for the course in Washington, but I once interviewed Obama, and the first thing he said to me was, "I haven't read your book." In other words, Obama is the sort of politician who wants you to know that he's not a politician. He doesn't bullshit. Whereas Holbrooke was kind of promoting himself. Small mistake. Second mistake, maybe slightly bigger. He said, "Mr. President, could you please call me Richard, not Dick? My wife prefers for people to call me Richard." So he corrected the new president in a way that seemed a little bit maybe weak. And the third thing he said was, his eyes teared up, and he said, "You know, you don't have to be an African-American to cry." In other words, I want you to know how moved I am to finally get to meet our first black president. And we all know enough about Obama to imagine that this was exactly not what he wanted to hear. That was the first minute of their relationship. And it went downhill from there. And it really was a failure of both men. Holbrooke couldn't read Obama, was too sure of himself to see that he'd lost Obama and that he was doing all the wrong things in meetings when he would lecture and go on and on about Vietnam. But Obama also maybe was too inexperienced and maybe a little insecure and pushed Holbrooke away, undermined him, let people around him know that he despised Holbrooke. He once said, while Holbrooke was pontificating on the video screen, he said to the officials around the Situation Room table, who talks like that? And that was the end of Holbrooke. So rather than getting over his own feelings and using Holbrooke, who could have been useful to him, he humiliated Holbrooke. And so for the last 2 years of his life, Holbrooke was in a frantic losing battle to try to stay relevant and to give Obama the advice that he had, and that it was good advice, which was, this looks a lot like the first war that I ever saw, Vietnam. And the only way we're going to resolve this war in Afghanistan is by talking to the enemy, which was how we finally got out of Vietnam. We have to talk to the Taliban. That was not a message that Obama or the generals or Hillary Clinton wanted to hear. And so Holbrooke's life ended with this very, I think, wise idea unrealized. And here we are 10 years later, and in a much worse position, still trying to figure out how to talk our way out of Afghanistan. His life ended in Hillary Clinton's office, the Secretary of State's office, the office he had always wanted to occupy himself, when she looked at him during a meeting and his face had turned an unnatural red, and she said, "My God, Richard, what's happening to you?" His aorta had just burst. He was taken to the hospital. The last hour of his life, which I describe in pretty minute detail, he was absolutely himself in every way, dictating to his aide, yelling in pain, flirting with the cardiologist, preparing for the statement that would be released after his surgery, trying to do everything at once, but he didn't survive the surgery. He died in action, and you could say he died of a broken heart. You can see that Hillary actually really liked Richard Holbrooke and really cared for him. And she was brokenhearted when he died too. She really lost a friend as well as an advisor. So beyond his career, there was his character and his personal life, which I spend a lot of time on in the book. He was Diane Sawyer's boyfriend for 7 years until, exhausted, she finally kicked him out of her apartment and went off with Mike Nichols. And Holbrooke's ego, I think, was more bruised than his heart. He loved to be around the famous Wall Street types, basketball players. Here he is as the UN ambassador under Bill Clinton with Hakeem Olajuwon and Dikembe Mutombo, movie stars. He loved adventure. Here he is poking the Dalai Lama in the chest, telling him what's what, showing off his friendship with Robert De Niro. He ate too much. He saw more movies than most of us have even heard of and was not a snob about it. His favorite was There's Something About Mary. He had numerous affairs. He was the kind of sexist who could only really reveal himself to women. Men he was too competitive with, but women is where Holbrooke was at his most vulnerable, and so I spend a lot of time on his relations with his wives and his girlfriends. He reminds me of one of those protagonists in a great 19th century novel, making his way up to the top, never achieving what he wanted, and trying to prevail against an adversarial world. He had egotism and idealism in immense quantities. The egotism made some people detest him, and the idealism made some people revere him. He was one of the few Americans I know of at the top of power who really truly cared about the rest of the world, especially about people in places where there was great suffering. Here he is in a Pakistani refugee camp, and I sometimes think that he could be rude and cruel and dismiss people whom he didn't consider worthy, but he never listened more carefully than he did to people like this refugee. He really paid attention, which I can't tell you how rare that is at the top of government. He was the son of Jewish refugees himself, refugees from Hitler and Stalin. He had a lifelong passion for humanitarian causes. He was critical of the militarization of our foreign policy, which he saw beginning in Vietnam and going all the way to Afghanistan. But he also believed that America was a force for good, and that America always had to get involved in the world. We had to be in the lead, and who better to lead us in the lead than himself? Now, the results were often as harmful as they were helpful. This is a story that begins in Vietnam and ends in Afghanistan. But the lessons to be learned are not simple ones. We always seem to learn the lesson of the last war. So in Vietnam, we assumed we were on the right side and could easily win with firepower as we had in World War II. We were wrong. When it came to Bosnia, we assumed it would be another Vietnam and we should stay out. And while we stayed out, 100,000 people were killed in a genocidal war. We were wrong again. When it came to Iraq and Afghanistan, we should be there nation building because we had succeeded in the Balkans. Wrong again. The lessons of the American century are actually ambiguous. One thing I did learn, though, in writing about Holbrooke, as I said, was how utterly human government work is and how brutal and how much it can destroy the people who are doing it. Decisions at the highest level, especially in foreign policy, reflect above all the character and relations of the ones making them, with all their flaws, their irrationality, their ignorance. Holbrooke once wrote in his diary, "Often one has to make decisions based on 2% of the information one ought to have. So one needs a set of guiding principles, a value system, and rock-hard integrity, or else one is buffeted by public opinion polls, pressure, and the confusion of the bureaucracy's competing claims. Without character, one can lose one's way." And among the incredibly intense relationships of Holbrooke's career, the most important was with Tony Lake, who was his contemporary in the Foreign Service, who went to Vietnam with him, where they were best friends. They were the bright young lights of the Foreign Service. And then in a story I'm not going to tell you because I don't want to ruin it, Holbrooke betrayed Lake in the most personal way possible, and they became enemies. They served together under succeeding secretaries of state. Here they are with Cyrus Vance during the Carter years and with Bill Clinton. And you can see from the look that Lake is shooting Holbrooke that by this point, their relationship has become toxic, and it actually had deep effects on American policy, because you can't separate out the character and the relationships from the policies. Holbrooke was a diplomat. Here he is, by the way, at the very end of his life. He was a diplomat, but this is not really a book about foreign policy. It's a character study in ambition and a portrait of an era in American life, the era when America thought of itself as the indispensable leader. And finally, I'm going to play you a snippet of Holbrooke's recorded diary, which he kept in the last months of his life. He's 3 months away from dying here, and you can hear it in his voice. But he's not talking in this bit about the war in Afghanistan. He's talking about having just seen the revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center, which has had a really surprisingly profound effect on him.
Monday, August 23rd, 7 a.m. Yesterday, the 22nd, Katya and I went to the final performance of the revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center with Frank Rich and Alex Witchell and Linda Janklo. It was a fantastic night, afternoon in the theater, maybe the best ever. The fantastic production, which I found immensely moving. Men were crying, myself included. I tried to understand why that show had such an enormous emotional impact on us. For me, it was the combination of the beauty of the show and its music, and the capturing in that show of so many moments in American history. the show itself, opening in New York and the height of New York's greatness, 1949. The theme, Americans at war in a distant land or islands in the South Pacific. The sense of loss of American optimism and our feeling that we could do anything. The contrast with today. It was very powerful. And I kept thinking of where we were today, our nation. Our lack of confidence in our own ability to lead compared to where we were in 1949 when it came out, evoking an era only 5 years or 7 years earlier, when we had gone to the most distant corners of the globe and saved civilization.
So like Holbrooke, the American century combined heroic and destructive impulses, nobility and hubris, the sense that we could do anything and the impulse to do everything. But I really only understood what this book was about on election night in 2016, when I suddenly realized, just a few years after Holbrooke's death, that the era he embodied was now over. We were entering something new, something diminished. And I understood then that what I was writing was now history. Thank you very much.
That was George Packer from a Portland Arts and Lectures event in October 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Ligori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.